You are about to hear Voices from the Mighty Pen Project on the Virginia Voice. And for the Virginia Voice, I'm Lou Dean. The Mighty Pen Project was founded by Richmond best-selling author David L. Robbins in partnership with the Virginia War Memorial to provide writing instruction to those who have experienced our nation's military events, either through their service or as a supporter of the military. Each of those involved in the Mighty Pen Project have a personal story to tell. The Mighty Pen Project teaches them how to tell it. With us is David Aldridge, a Vietnam vet who is participating in the Mighty Pen Project. David, you're going to read your story about your return from Vietnam in the late 60s.
Yes, after my first tour, I came back and had the unappetizing experience of having people spit on me and throw stuff on me up at San Francisco International. A lot of people had that experience, and the police just stood by for some reason. They had some sort of agreement with the hippies that they could do what they wanted to do and would not be arrested. So we were assaulted when we got off the planes and we walked into the terminals. And that was November 1967.
How old were you then?
I was 22 years old at that time.
Relatively young to understand what was going on with the hippies.
Yes, sir.
At the time.
I really didn't understand the depth of the hatred that they had for us. Later, I heard about some documentary stories that had been going around on TV about, especially one that was up in Canada by the French, that was anti-war and anti-American, and the Canadians were even more rabid against the American war. So I don't blame them. You know, when you've just listened to one side of a story, the propaganda can be overwhelming.
But here you had been in Vietnam, been shot at, been in the middle of a war. You come home, find that the hippies are against it. Several other people are against it, with very personal beliefs on it. And yet, I understand you found it difficult to communicate with your family. Different level, of course, but still difficult to talk to them.
Well, I had been in some very large battles, and I had been wounded twice. I had two Purple Hearts at that point. And, of course, my mother was terrified that I was going to die over there. So that's why it was tough for her to talk about it. I don't understand why the rest of my family found it difficult, but they did. And all of my friends from high school and college had already made up their minds that we were in the wrong over there and we needed to be out of Vietnam. So there was no discussion with them either. I told my friends, if you want to know about Vietnam, fly over there and see.
Here it is 40, 50 years later, and you're writing about it. What led you to the Mighty Pen Project?
My wife saw an ad in the paper, and she said, you're going. I said, okay.
Had you had any writing experience before?
Sure. I've been writing my whole life, but it's extremely difficult to write about some of the things I write about. I was there for three tours. I was in the infantry, and I've only just recently written about my first firefight.
Was that difficult to do?
Yes, sir. It was, because two very wonderful human beings got killed that day, and another soldier who was a great soldier was horribly wounded. So it was very difficult to talk about.
You mentioned you have been a writer. Has the writing for the Mighty Pen Project helped in any way?
Oh, absolutely.
Tell me.
Under Mr. Robbins, his tutelage, I would say, his mentoring, I have learned to structure my writing a little better. And it's not so rambling as it perhaps was before. And so I really appreciate everything that Dave Robbins has brought to the Virginia War Memorial with the Mighty Pen Project. He has helped dozens and dozens of people get their story out, and It's a wonderful project. I can't say enough about it.
What you're telling me is that the writing, the stories are in these people. Dave Robbins helped to bring it out.
Absolutely. He does that. And they do it in a in an environment that's very supportive. And that's the thing about Dave. He encourages you. He critiques you when he has to, but he also supports everything that you write. And we support each other. And I just can't say enough about the other people in the project either.
I'm flying blind here, but does he go sentence by sentence saying, you could have structured this sentence better?
He does.
He goes to that depth.
He does. He gets very in-depth, and he's sensitive to other people's feelings, but also he's going to tell you exactly what you need to hear to be a better writer. And so I appreciate that about him. He's very blunt.
Dave, as you know, does a tremendous amount of personal research for many of his novels, and yet you bring to it first person. You've been there.
Yes. I've also read some of his books. A story called Low Bird that he wrote recently, and I've got it at home. I read some of the combat scenes in there, and he got those right. So I'm telling you, this is a guy who will research until he absolutely gets the character or the scene absolutely correct. And I've been on the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And what he wrote about the Ho Chi Minh Trail in Low Bird was absolutely spot on. And so I really enjoy his work that he does. But I also enjoy this fastidiousness that he has and that he brings to a story. He won't write it if it's not right.
You're hearing from Dave Aldridge, and he's about to tell you a story. You're about to read a bit of his story. What is the title of it?
Going Back Home.
And is this an excerpt?
Yes, well, I reduced it a little bit due to the reading, but it's normally about 10 pages long. And I reduced it to half of that. So there's a little bit more to the story, but...
And you call it?
Going Back Home. It was another gloriously hot day when we departed Benoit Air Base on 8 November 1967. The big jet lurched down the runway with the fastest takeoff I had ever experienced. Everyone applauded. The pilot said we had been chased down the runway by Viet Cong mortars. Half the plane fired up cigarettes and settled in for the long flight home. We landed at San Francisco International and headed for the terminal. A gauntlet of hippies awaited us. I thought they were there to shake our hands. They proceeded to assault as many soldiers and sailors as they could. Four San Francisco policemen just stood by and watched. I could not fathom what the hippies were so enraged about as they spit on us, cursed us, and threw stuff at us from some paper bags. They were possessed. They screamed, "Murderers! Baby killers! Rapists!" There was no room for discussion. Finally, the group of hippies slowly backed off and we continued into the terminal. Still confused by what had just happened, we claimed our bags and got in line for customs. I didn't know what to think about all the hippies, but I felt betrayed somehow. When we got to Oakland Army Base, they came on the bus to tell us it would take us a while to process us. We were marched over to the mess hall where we were given a steak dinner with all the trimmings. The steak was tasteless and unchewable. I could not help thinking this was a bad omen. They paid me what I was owed and gave me a plane ticket to my home in Midway City, California. When I got to the airport, I changed into civilian clothes. No more rabid hippies for me. 4 hours later, I was home. My mother exploded out at the front door of our home on Washington Avenue and joyfully embraced me. She kept saying over and over, thank God, while gently weeping. She held on and wouldn't let go. Finally, she released me, and my father, cold and remote as ever, reached out and shook my hand. After a good meal and a beer, we all settled into the living room. After a little chit-chat, an invisible wall began to take shape and impose itself between my family members and myself. I couldn't shake the feeling that we had lost our ability to communicate somehow. I could not tell them about my year in Vietnam, a year of chaos, trauma, and heart-stopping fear. When I did try to talk, I found myself grasping for the right words. The right words never came to rescue me from the huge chasm that stood between us. The silences were enormous as I just stared into space. I know that I seemed to be staring at nothing in particular, but in my mind I was seeing all my friends who had just been killed a few days before, on 17 October 1967. All 62 of them. I loved them as my own brothers. We had fought a savage battle with the North Vietnamese, and now my friends were dead. I had been told to go to graves registration to identify everyone. Each one had to be pulled out of the body bag and identified. It was gruesome work. After 2 hours of going through all the body bags, I had been emotionally exhausted. Had I been able to weep, perhaps I could have gotten some relief, but I had been just too numb. All the survivors of the battle ended up getting drunk for the next week. We got new guys in every day, and they tiptoed around all of us old guys. Well, that was just fine with me. 3 weeks later, I left for the States. Being back in America was anticlimactic. Something was missing, but I couldn't figure out what that something was. I bought a motorcycle, and it was good to feel the wind in my face. Driving fast became a bad habit. My family, my other friends from high school, and strangers in bars didn't want to hear about Vietnam, and that was just as hurtful as a bunch of hippies spitting at me. I got back into college and maxed out every test. I had clarity of mind, and studying was easy for the first time in my life. But getting all A's didn't satisfy me either. I began to feel even more alienated from everyone. I thought about my friend Ronald Dominic, who had survived what is now called the Battle of Ontan. With horrible wounds, he had been medevaced to Japan and finally ended up at Beaumont General Hospital in Fort Bliss, Texas, which was near his home. I had tracked him down and called the ward he was on, and we had a great conversation. I told him not to be too shocked if I showed up to visit him. We laughed as we hung up. From the time I had been discharged back in November 1967 until April 68, I had been having some recurring dreams. The dreams would repeat themselves, sometimes as many as 10 times, and then another series would begin. Some dreams were about ambushes that were blown, and events in the dream were set out in a certain order. I had dreams about ground attacks. In them, I was issuing orders like I was in charge. I would wake up sweating and confused, wondering why I would be having the same dream time and again. The stress of it all was becoming unbearable. Finally, the thought hit me like a tsunami. I have to go back to Vietnam. As soon as I thought it, I felt a peace descend over me like a benediction. It felt right. I told my family and my professors, one of whom started crying, and I told my new girlfriend, who did not take it very well. I decided to visit Ron Dominic first and then go down to the enlistment office and ask to go back to Vietnam. I loaded my motorcycle and took off for Fort Bliss, Texas. When I arrived, the MPs just waved me right on in. I had forgotten about the shotgun wrapped up, unconcealed behind me in my sleeping bag. When I found Dominic, I was so happy. I embraced him and my eyes got moist. Ron introduced me to everyone in his ward and then to the nurses, saying, "This is my friend Dave I told you all about from Vietnam." All of the guys on the ward were Vietnam returnees. They were of all races in the ward. Some were amputees and a couple of them were suffering from head wounds. One of the guys was blind and was helped about by another wounded vet. I went around the room and shook their hands, asking who they had served with. The nurses let me sleep on the ward in one of the empty beds. They also got me a meal card so I could eat for free. One of the nurses told me I could bring the motorcycle up onto the ward and park it in the hallway, but they would have to store the shotgun in the office for now. Everybody thought it was just too cool that I had a shotgun with me for the ride from California. I said, you should have seen the MP's face at the gate. He didn't know whether to shit or go blind. Everybody laughed. The next day, Dominic got a pass. We headed for the first bar we came to and walked in. The guy behind the bar was white, about 50 years old and balding. He nodded at me and said, you can stay, but your black friend has to go. He can't drink here. A hot surge of anger hit me and I headed for the bartender. Dominic grabbed my arm and started ushering me out of the bar, saying, it's okay, Dave. That's just the way it is here in Texas. We'll go somewhere else to drink. I never thought of Dominic as black. He was simply my brother. Seething, all I could say was, God, the ignorance. We finally decided to go over to Juarez, Mexico, and I'm glad we did. We had a wonderful time over there. When I said goodbye to Ron and his buddies 2 days later, it was a joyless parting. Everyone knew what my chances were of surviving another tour in the infantry. 3 weeks later, I was back in Vietnam. I managed to talk my way back to the 1st Infantry Division and then back to my old battalion in Lai Ke. The new battalion commander of the 2nd of the 28th Infantry asked if I would accept a battlefield commission, and I declined because he said I would have to go to another unit if I said yes. I wanted to be back in my old company, Delta Company. He shook my hand and told the sergeant major, send him back to Delta. Over at Delta Company, Lieutenant Joe Devine took me straight in to meet our captain. I brought myself to the position of attention and reported to Delta CO. I said, Private First Class David Aldridge reporting, sir. And he said, you're Aldridge? You're the one who just left the 2nd Platoon? And I answered, yes, sir. Lieutenant Devine was my platoon leader. The CO just stared at me for a few seconds and said, I've heard about you, Aldridge. You want to be my 3-6? 3-6 was a call sign. 3 meant the 3rd platoon and 6 meant the leader, the guy in charge. It was a position normally held by a 2nd lieutenant or a 1st lieutenant. I was stunned. All of the stars seemed to align in that moment, and I immediately said, yes, sir, I would be honored to be your 3rd platoon leader, but what about my rank? I'm only a PFC. The captain said, don't worry about the rank. Just don't wear any. I will promote you as fast as battalion will let me. You're my 3-6. He stood and offered me his hand. We shook and I saluted and left the orderly room. I looked around the company area. It was a familiar place, all right, but it also just felt right. I breathed deeply and headed to the arms room to get a weapon. It was good to be back home again. Home is where the heart is. I was right where I was supposed to be, and for the first time in my life, I knew it.
David Rasmussen, reading from his story, Going Back Home. You are listening to Voices from the Virginia Pen Project on the Virginia Voice. For the Virginia Voice, I'm Lou Dean. The Virginia Pen Project is a writing class for those who have served in our military and their supporters. With us now is Lynn Rasmussen, who is going to read to you a story by her Mighty Pen Project classmate, Steve Tedder. Lynn, who is Steve Tedder?
Steve Tedder served in Vietnam in about 1969 and 1970, and he took the class at the Mighty Pen with me, and he was my adjacent seatmate. We had a lot of fun in that class, and Steve learned to write so well, and he had so many good stories to tell. But Steve passed away in the spring of 2016, and that's why I'm here reading his story today.
How did you get involved with the Mighty Pen Project?
I got involved because the class was open not only to veterans, but veterans' families. And my father was a World War II vet, and my brother was a Vietnam vet, and served about a year or two before Steve Tedder did. And my brother was drafted. And it was a very reluctant person there. He would tell me stories about when he came home from Vietnam, and I remember this very well. There were no parades for those vets. There were no celebrations. People did not talk to them about their experiences. So it was kind of rough. And taking the Mighty Pen class got me involved in hearing the veterans' stories. And many of these stories they had never shared with their families or their friends. They didn't start sharing until they got into that class and they were writing. And it was just amazing to hear the stories.
Lynn Rasmussen, please read for us Steve Tedder's story.
Peaches and Pound Cake by Steve Tedder. December 1970. God, it was hot, pushing 100 degrees. I was sitting on my butt in the meager shade of a Kiowa helicopter on a hot PSP helipad. My pilot, W02 White, was back in one of the slicks talking pilot talk with the Slick and Cobra pilots. There were three teams working today. We were next up, and we'd be back up in an hour or so. One team had just returned and refueled, setting down behind us next to the airstrip at Tainai. My new buddy Flegler got out of the Kiowa and was tying down the main rotor blade when I walked up to him and asked how he liked flying in the Scouts. He was grinning from ear to ear and said that he loved it. It sure beat riding around in the bush in an APC. I agreed. Soon thereafter, a Huey sat down behind us, and the crew chief dropped out several cases of sea rations. Lunch had arrived. We went over to the Huey to see what was on the menu. Being an NCO and a little bit faster, I picked first from what was left in the case. The grunts and other crews had beaten us, so there wasn't a lot left. I didn't know what I was getting since the sea ration cases were always opened upside down. Whichever box you picked is what you got. That way no one could hog the good stuff. Seemed nobody liked the ham and eggs. Having made our picks, Flegler and I went back to my aircraft where I pulled out my stove. My stove was simply an empty sea ration can with holes on the side. You would put in a little JP4 fuel from the drain plug, mix it in with sand, and you had a pretty decent stove. Perfect for cooking turkey loaf, which is what I had that day. I also had my favorite dessert, canned peaches. When he saw the peaches that I was about to open, Flegler offered to trade, and I said, "Nope, no way." He then told me that tomorrow was his birthday, and it would make a great early birthday present. This made me chuckle, and I told him, "That may be so, but I wasn't trading." I told him I would get the mess sergeant to bake him a cake. Soon after, my team went out to the AO and poked around for 2 hours. Not finding anything, we returned to Quan Lo. I had only known Flegler for a week. I was walking out to the mess hall, and I saw this guy getting off a Huey carrying his duffel bag. He stood out because he looked like a kid, and he was wearing an 11th armored calf patch on his left shoulder. I went up to him and asked if he was lost. He said no, that he had transferred to A Troop, and asked me where the orderly room was. I told him it was time for chow, and we could eat first. After sitting down with our food, I started grilling him on how he came to be at Quan Lo. He explained that his MOS was 11D, and he had arrived in country back in July and been assigned to the 11th Armored Cav as a grunt on an APC. He said they were noisy, stank, and made big targets. Every time he looked up and saw a helicopter, he yearned to be a door gunner. Finally, his CO granted his wish, and here he was. When reporting to the first sergeant, he got his assignment not as a door gunner, but as an observer in the scout platoon. I had Top assign him to my hooch. This guy really seemed all right. He was so new to the Army, 5 months in Nam, but less than a year in the Army. I got him squared away with his bunk, took him down to the arms room and supply room, and then we went out to the flight line where I explained what he would be doing as a scout. He was amazed that he would be sitting in the front seat right next to the pilot. Sure beats being a door gunner. Norman was like a kid on Christmas. The only drawback to all this was he couldn't fly until he passed a flight physical, which would take a few days, as it meant having to catch a flight to Ben Hoi, where they gave it. A week later, Norman was all ready to go on his first mission in the AO. I was also flying that day. We had become pretty tight that week. Even though I was an NCO and he was a PFC, we had a lot in common. We had both spent time in the bush, and we both loved flying. I learned what his life was like growing up in a small town in Oregon. He was amazed that I had actually spent my summers cropping tobacco at my uncle's home in North Carolina and had dropped out of school to join the Army. I helped him get everything ready for that first flight, loading the weapons, M60 and minigun, as well as placing the grenades on the wire within easy reach. He was flying the First Light mission with Captain Reynolds. I would be flying later with Mr. White. We met up again at Tay Nang, where he rested and had lunch. The next day was December 7th, Pearl Harbor Day. I was not scheduled to fly that day, so as soon as everyone had left the hooch, I went down to the supply room and finagled a box of sea rations from the supply sergeant. Not just any box. I made sure I had a can of peaches and a canned pound cake. What could be better for your 20th birthday? Oh yeah, but we won't go there. I returned to the hooch and placed the cans on Norman's bunk. No card or candles. I knew he would know what they were for and who they were from. Flegler never returned to the hooch that day. He was killed in action that afternoon. I learned afterwards that he died a horrible death, suffering intense agony as he died. One story had it that he was attempted to throw a white phosphorus grenade and was shot, causing the grenade to fall in his lap. The other story was that they were receiving fire, and in his haste to mark the position for the Cobras, he dropped the grenade. His pilot stated that Norman did absorb the blast with his body in an attempt to shield him. The aircraft crashed, and it was several days before the pilot returned to the unit to give us the particulars. Personally, I really didn't care what the exact circumstances were. When I learned what had happened, I went over to his cot and retrieved the two cans, both of which I tossed out, telling myself, it don't mean nothing. That's what I learned. That's how you dealt with it. You really had to keep your emotions in check. You just had to carry on. We still had a job to do. Just like the other saying we learned to live by, don't get carried away and then get carried away. It was many years after I returned home before I gave much thought to those particular days. I do remember Private First Class Harold Norman Flagler talking, though. I remember his brown curly hair and his big-ass grin when he was talking.
You have heard Lynn Rasmussen reading a story by her Mighty Pen Project classmate, Steve Tedder. You are listening to Voices from the Virginia Pen Project on the Virginia Voice. The Mighty Pen Project was founded by Richmond best-selling author David L. Robbins in partnership with the Virginia War Memorial to provide writing instruction to those who have experienced our nation's military events, either through their service or as a supporter of the military. Each of those involved in the Mighty Pen Project have a personal story to tell. The Mighty Pen Project teaches them how to tell it. In this series of programs on the Virginia Voice, you will hear from as many as 15 participants in the Mighty Pen Project. Each has a different and very personal story to tell you. Most have to do with the war, and as has been said, war is hell. In telling you these stories, they tell it like they saw it, rough and uncut. These authors hope to give you a first-person experience of an heroic and sometimes tragic experience. For the Virginia Voice, I'm Lou Dean.